Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Charged in the U.S. in connection with 9/11 enters a new phase today, the completion of jury selection and opening statements for and against 37-year-old Frenchman Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker. Moussaoui had already pled guilty to conspiring with al-Qaeda, but says it was for a future attack, not 9/11. In this sentencing trial, he faces just two options, either life in prison or the death penalty. Joining us on the line from the courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, is Greg Gordon, Washington correspondent for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Greg, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What is the prosecution's argument against Moussaoui, and what do they have to prove in order to win the death penalty verdict, which is what they want?
The government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that if Moussaoui had told what he knew about the pending September 11th terror attacks, that those attacks would have been diminished or thwarted altogether.
So he, in essence, they're saying he allowed the plot to proceed by lying to the FBI. We have to remember he was already under arrest.
That's right. He was picked up while attending a flight school in the Twin Cities, where he was learning how to pilot a 747 jumbo jet. And when he pleaded guilty in April of last year, he contended that he didn't know any of the details of September 11th, although his responses and his comments in court have been somewhat erratic. And another time he also remarked, "I have much information. I know who plotted it, where they did it, and so forth, where they planned it, how they planned it." So it'll be interesting, maybe illuminating, to see what comes out, especially when Moussaoui himself takes the witness stand, which seems almost a certainty.
So to be clear, Greg, the government, the prosecutors, are not saying that he was supposed to be the 20th hijacker. They're just saying that if he'd told what he knew about al-Qaeda, he could have prevented 9/11.
That's correct. The government intimated, never said on the public record anywhere flatly, but intimated that he was the suspected 20th hijacker shortly after his arrest. But this has been an evolving case, and ultimately the government's theory of the case has been that Moussaoui was training for a follow-on attack, possibly to fly a plane into the White House. And I think that part of the reason that this evolution occurred is that as this case proceeded, the government made more captures of senior al-Qaeda leaders, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the suspected mastermind of the plot. It's been widely reported that he made the decision to keep Moussaoui out of the September 11th operation because he considered him to be too indiscreet.
Well, what is Moussaoui's defense?
The defense is essentially that the government knew more than Moussaoui did about September 11th, and what we're going to see from the defense lawyers is an attempt to put the FBI on trial to talk about how they had tracked some of the hijackers into the United States, knew their whereabouts. They had information from various intelligence sources about a pending attack, and that there had even been talk of turning jetliners into missiles.
And are they also expected to cite federal law that says people can only receive the death penalty if they actually did themselves kill someone?
The federal law states that you must take some overt act that directly contributes to someone's death. And what's unusual about this case, the government's going to contend that it was Moussaoui's omission that led that allowed the attacks to go forward, because he failed to carry out his duty to tell the government that this murderous plot was looming.
Moussaoui has been known to make outbursts in court up till today. Do you expect the same thing to happen once the arguments begin and once he goes on the stand?
Well, when he goes on the stand, I guess he'll be able to say within limitations what he wants, but the judge has reined him in, at least so far, by warning him that he's not going to sit in that courtroom if he erupts. And he is wearing a box, an electronic box, inside of his shirt in the back. And one of the deputy marshals, according to knowledgeable sources, people close to the case, one or more of the deputy marshals has a little push button that he can use to zap him, basically, if he gets out of line.
You're kidding.
I'm not.
Has that ever been done before?
I'm sure it has, but this is the first time I've witnessed it.
Well, we'll be interested to see if that gets used. Greg Gordon, thank you. Greg is Washington correspondent for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Iraq's president announced today that he would convene the new parliament for the first time next Monday. After that date, lawmakers will have 60 days to elect a new president, a prime minister, and cabinet. Also today, an American soldier was reportedly killed in the western Anbar province, pushing the American military death toll to 2,300. In Baghdad, explosions killed 14 Iraqis and wounded more than 50. Well, while violence continues in Iraq, we wanted to take a closer look at new research that suggests that advances in technology are changing the nature of what soldiers fear on the battlefield, making them less worried about themselves and more concerned about their families. Leonard Wong is a professor of military strategy at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He co-authored this new study, and he joins us on the line from his office. And Lenny, you started this study hoping to find what soldiers are afraid of. Tell us what you expected to find.
Well, traditionally, when you ask soldiers what produces the stress and the fear, there were several factors that that they can talk about. In the past, it's been lack of sleep, the tasteless food, the rain, the heat, also the psychological stresses, the fact that they never feel like they're away from the danger,
right,
that they're never completely free from that fear and anxiety.
Yeah,
and
that's
what I was expecting.
And this was in part based on a survey of Israeli defense forces. There were other things such as, you know, a fear of letting down their comrades.
Exactly. When you asked soldiers, specifically in the 1973 war, Israeli psychologists asked their soldiers, what's your biggest fear in battle? And they would say, letting down my comrades, or death, losing a limb.
Well, and we want to hear some sound directly from the soldiers, but you give us the headline first. What did you actually hear from the soldiers themselves? What was their biggest fear?
Surprisingly, they are not that afraid of death or fear of, you know, losing a limb, although that's always looms on the horizon. But what I heard and I was surprised with is that they said that they were concerned about if something happened to them, who would take care of their family? What would happen to their family? So it wasn't a fear of personal injury, but the consequences of that.
Let's listen.
The biggest thing that frightens me is not getting shot or anything like that, because that doesn't happen a whole lot anymore. But the you know, just be driving down the road to somewhere and something blow up, you know. And I guess I'm, you know, not being able to provide for my wife and child. That's
mm-hmm. Not being able to provide for my wife and child. No, it's not that that would be, as you said, surprising that they would think that. But what you discovered is that these soldiers are thinking more about their families than perhaps in other eras because of how they communicate with their families. What did you find when you started to look into that?
What I discovered was is when I asked them, how often do you communicate with your family, your wife, because I talked to all male soldiers, I was expecting them to say an email two or three times a week and maybe a phone call once a week. Instead, I got responses as twice a day, three times a day, as often as possible during the day, and I was shocked. And it turns out that they're calling home, they're IMing home, instant messaging home, very, very much.
And there's another reason for this. It has to do with, as you found out, the way the field operations are set up. There's something called a forward operating base?
That's correct. These FOBs, or forward operating bases, are traditionally airfields used to support operations, but what the armies use them as is little islands, little oases, where they can put soldiers deep into where the action is. And so it's a stark difference from the outside the wire to inside the wire. And so these FOBs, they eliminate a lot of the former stresses and causes of fear.
But they're not used as much as support bases. They're the base. That's where
exactly
people live.
Right. They're on the front lines.
Right.
They are on the. It's not the rear area anymore. And they're safe. They try to give the soldiers as much comfort. They try to provide good food. They try to provide diversions. And so a lot of the causes of fear in the past have been mitigated.
Yeah, we have images of, for instance, soldiers during Vietnam hunkered down, 25 of them, in the jungle for 100 days. Not on their base. And you say the most prominent thing that comes out of this is that these FOBs are giving soldiers more communication technology.
Right. Their psychological readiness goes up because on those FOBs, in addition to all those physical things that I was talking about, there's also an ability to leave the environment they're in by connecting with home. So they may be distant, but they're not disconnected. Three things come into play here. First is that we're talking young people. And these young people are very comfortable with the technology. You know, email is something that us older folks think is technology, but for them, instant messaging is the way to go. 84% of the youth cohort, according to some survey done by the Pew Internet Survey, 84% of the youth use IM, whereas only 42% of older adults use it. And so when you look at younger soldiers, they are very into instant messaging. Another factor that happened was after the war, a lot of kiosks popped up around these FOBs set up by Iraqis that relied on fiber optic infrastructure. Well, during the post-war chaos, a lot of that fiber optic infrastructure got taken away, and so the Army looked around and they contracted with a small outfit out of Virginia, and they started putting in internet kiosks, but almost as an afterthought, they put something in called voice over the internet protocol phones, VoIP phones. And what that did was it drove the price of phone calling, telephone service from Iraq back to the United States or Germany drastically down, from about $1.50 down to 4 cents a minute.
So they're calling a lot.
And there's one other factor is, and that was a top-down approach that the Army brought the internet to the base, to the FOBs, but a bottom-up approach also started. And that's where, when I talked to soldiers, I discovered that they have internet right beside their bunks. And I asked them how they got that, and they referred to somebody named, vaguely named Baghdad Bob, who came up to them and said, I will set up a satellite dish, I will give you wireless internet, and you give me, you know, $500 to set up the internet, the satellite dish, and then $30 a month, and I'll give you wireless internet access. And so they're getting broadband wireless internet at their bunks, which they're using to instant message or VoIP phone call home.
And as you say, sometimes several times a day. And you write that with these phone calls, instant messaging, and all of that, the concept of family has shifted for deployed soldiers from the abstract to the concrete. What do you mean by that?
Well, it used to be when soldiers deployed, the family was they loved their families just like soldiers today do, but the family was tucked into the back of their mind. It was a concept that was resurrected right before you went to bed, a concept that you woke up and thought about your family. But during the day, during the busy times, you sort of pushed the family to the back, knowing that you weren't going to see them in a while and it's time to focus on the mission.
Well, in fact, the military encouraged that. They shielded you from news of your family.
Exactly. Because if you knew the military was taking care of your family, then and you couldn't talk to them very much, then you just sort of moved on with life.
Concentrated on your job.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Things are different now, though, because when I talk to soldiers and I ask them, well, how often do you think about your wife? They responded with, all the time. It was really amazing.
That's Leonard Wong of the Army War College, who did a study to find out what soldiers feared on the battlefield, and he was shocked to find out that their thoughts and their fears were of their family, not the enemy. Well, we're going to hear more about how technology is changing the experience of soldiers during war in a moment. But later, the Supreme Court has ruled colleges must accept military recruiters if they accept federal funds. One reason cited by the court, that the ranks of the military are growing too thin. Stay with us. More with Leonard Wong ahead, here and now. At the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And Lenny, we were just talking about the fact that soldiers are thinking about their families much more than you ever expected as a researcher, in large part because they're talking to them as often as three or four times a day. So you found that troops were speaking to their families more often. What else did you find?
Even the content of their communication had changed from highly emotional, charged events to talking about routine things like, how did the kids do? Well, let me talk to the children. They have webcams. And so they see each other, and the soldiers are not relinquishing their role as husband and father as soldiers had done in the past.
Well, and in fact, you found that this also became a one-way street in some ways, because while soldiers still were taking on family problems, they were not sharing their stresses with their spouses. Let's listen.
She's home with my daughter every day, which can be stressful. That can be, in a lot of ways, that can be more stressful than this. So I let her kind of pour everything out onto me.
Yeah.
And
so that's interesting, though. You don't pour stuff on her.
Right. Because it's a different stress, you know.
Lenny Wong, you found that perhaps one reason why so many of the soldiers did not want to burden their wife, and you did talk to men, burden their wives with any of their stresses, is that many of them came from single-parent homes?
Right. It was amazing how many young soldiers we talked to came from homes where they didn't experience the type of family that they wanted. And so we saw a lot of soldiers saying, we're not going to sit back and allow circumstances to keep us separated. And so they used the internet to try to build their relationships, to keep the family going, knowing that they might have come from a background that wasn't as desirable as the one they're trying to build.
Well, and some would say that could be the upside of this, it's building a stronger family, a stronger bond. But what are the downsides?
The downsides is that we have two institutions. We have the military and we have the family, and both are what sociologist Mady Siegel calls greedy institutions. In other words, for those institutions to survive, they need all of you. They need all of your attention, all of your energy, all your time, and all your loyalty. And so that's understandable. The military wants all of it because you've got a big mission to do. And yet the family wants all of it because it's a very important relationship that you have to keep nurturing. We used to deal with that by saying, you leave your family behind and you get letters and you still take care of them in a certain way, but the Army will take care of the rest and society will take care of the rest. But now what we've done is we introduced the competition between these two institutions, and we haven't really decided, so what's the impact of that?
Well, and before we get your thoughts on that, let's listen again to some tape that shows how the family is a constant presence on the battlefield.
How often do you think about her during the day?
I don't ever stop thinking about her. It's like a constant role, you know? It's like a constant thing. Uh-huh. I'll be sitting up thinking about the mission that I got to do and make sure that the mission is straight and everything's straight. Then all of a sudden, she'll pop up in my head.
Really?
Yeah, all of a sudden. And it's always like that. It's always like that. Even going through the towns that we go through, we clear all these buildings, knock out all these towns, and knock out all this stuff, and I'll sit up and I'll say, okay, how's my wife doing? That's exactly what goes on in my mind.
An American soldier in Iraq, talking to Lenny Wong, a professor of military strategy at the Army War College. For Lenny's study, it's called The FOB, How the Forward Operating Base is Changing the Life of Combat Soldiers. Again, those bases have become sort of little secure islands with a lot of communication. And Lenny Wong, I have these images from old war movies of soldiers taking off their helmets, and there's the picture of their sweetheart. And so are you really sure that it's that different from the way it used to be?
I think when they took off their helmet and looked at their picture, they weren't communicating. They were thinking about them. But today, what's happened is that the family now is, they're communicating synchronously at the same time. And so all the things that go on at home, the soldiers don't want to be removed from that. And so they're able to live in two worlds. They go out the gate, they're hyper-vigilant. And yet when they come back, they send off an IM right away to their family.
And what do you think the result of this is? I mean, you said we don't yet know what this is going to mean. Obviously, it does mean in the immediate that this is what they fear. They fear, something happening to their family. That's what you set out to find out. But does it affect their performance?
Well, I asked them straight up, does this bother you? When you hear problems from home, don't you take it with you? And they all responded, no, I can put it away. When I go out that gate, it's a complete focus on the mission. And maybe this generation, these young kids, they can do that because they're the multitaskers. They're the ones that we always pointed at that, their attention span is so short, they don't focus on things. Well, maybe they can handle this.
And does it affect, though, their unit cohesiveness? Because in the back in the day, the band of brothers was your family.
Exactly. And that's where commanders have to be aware of what's going on, is that a commander needs to look at his unit or her unit and say, now I have a competition for their attention. Now I have a competition for their time and loyalty. I need to take that into account and develop activities, develop a plan on how we develop that cohesion and make sure that cohesion doesn't get broken up because you have people going off and saying, I'd rather spend time with my family, I'd rather spend energy with my family.
It doesn't seem as if this is something that can be changed either. I mean, it'd be like rolling back the clock.
No, we definitely won't go back. It's the expectation now of soldiers in the American Army when they get deployed, when's the internet access going to be installed? So we're not going back, and I don't think we would want to. What we need to do, though, is we need to look at it and say, let's recognize it. Just like in the old days, after mail call, commanders would be tipped off to say, hey, keep an eye on Private Jones. He just got a Dear John letter. Well, commanders today now have to know, hey, the soldiers are talking all their time to their families, so keep an eye on that. We need to tip off the families before the soldiers deploy. Hey, got to be careful what you tell them, because you might be talking to them about Junior having a bad day and he doesn't want to go to school, and they're going out the gate in the next 5 minutes. So let's think about that.
Leonard Wong, a professor of military strategy at the Army War College. His study is called See You at the FOB. Lenny, it's the letters See You, that's shorthand.
That's correct. That's instant messaging lingo that some of us older folks don't use.
See You as an S-E-E-Y-O-U at the FOB. How the Forward Operating Base is Changing the Life of Combat Soldiers. Lenny, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
But to be clear, the email address is the letter C and the letter U. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is today that colleges that accept federal money must allow military recruiters on campus, despite university objections to the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on homosexuals. Several law schools and their professors claim that based on free speech protections, they should not be forced to associate with military recruiters. Well, joining us is Boston College law professor Kent Greenfield. He leads the coalition of law schools that brought the suit against the federal law known as the Solomon Amendment, which mandates that universities give the military the same access as other recruiters or forfeit federal money. And Professor Greenfield, what is your reaction to today's decision?
Well, clearly we're not happy about it, but we see this as just a skirmish in a larger civil rights battle, a civil rights battle against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, which we are winning. I think we will win in the long run.
Well, the justices said that, you know, you don't have to associate with a recruiter just because they're on campus. But they also said that they feel that they really need this at a time when the ranks of the military are so low. Do you have any sympathy with that?
Well, there is a strand in this opinion that picks up on the strands of other opinions through the years of a lot of deference to the military on the part of the court. Of course, the irony here is that the military is restricting people who really want to serve their country because of their sexual orientation. We're excluding people from the military who really want to serve their country.
So
we're doing so on morally and morally unethical grounds.
So you are as much about changing the policy of the military as you were about changing the Solomon Amendment, the law behind this. But, well, you know, what follows from that thinking, though, is that if Boston College and other universities feel strongly enough that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is wrong, the school could choose not to take federal money and then not have this conflict.
Right, but universities throughout America, including Boston College, depend on federal funding for a range of things. So this funding is crucial for the work that universities do. What we were saying was that universities should not be put at the choice of saying we need to do what we have to do in order to be a great university on the one hand and give up our rights to protest on the other. So what one silver lining from this opinion is that the court clearly says that law schools and other educational institutions can continue to protest, and we will be continuing to protest against discrimination against our own students.
Kent Greenfield is a professor of law at Boston College. He objects to today's decision by the Supreme Court, which ruled unanimously that colleges that accept federal money must allow military recruiters on campus. Professor Greenfield, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Ma Bell is making a comeback. AT&T has announced plans to buy Bell South for $67 billion. It's one of the biggest mergers in history, and it also reestablishes much of the former AT&T monopoly, good old Ma Bell, that was broken up by federal regulators back in the 80s. And now phone companies are doing more than they were then. Bell South generates much of its revenue from cell phones and a broadband network. So the deal gives AT&T a stronger foothold in providing high-speed internet and television services. Consumer advocates say the deal could mean higher cell phone and long-distance phone bills. Well, joining us now is Brian Groh of Business Week magazine. He's speaking to us from the magazine's Atlanta Bureau. And Brian, Bell South was one of the baby bells created when Ma Bell, AT&T, was broken up. So is this going back to the way it was?
Well, Robin, after AT&T was broken up, there were seven baby bells, and these days there were two last Lone Rangers, Bell South and Quest, and now there's one.
Right.
Quest stands alone as the only independent one. That follows a wave of mergers over the last 18 months in which we saw SBC swallow up AT&T itself, the old parent company that had become a long-distance and wireless provider. And we saw Verizon snap up MCI.
Right.
It was a logical next step because, in large part, this deal is driven by the desire to have a single ownership of singular wireless.
Now, let's explain. AT&T orchestrated this deal to buy Bell South to, as you say, gain full control of singular wireless. They'd shared that with Bell South, so now AT&T owns it entirely.
You got it. The old SBC, which rebranded itself AT&T recently, and Bell South had a joint venture in which there was a 60-40 ownership breakdown of singular wireless and a 50-50 management structure.
Well, the deal hasn't been approved yet, but if it is, how likely is it to affect consumers, as consumer advocates say it will?
Interestingly, in the short term, I don't know that consumers are going to see any impact. In fact, arguably, prices could fall in the area, for example, of high-speed internet. SBC, now named AT&T, actually is one of the most aggressive price cutters in high-speed internet. In fact, lowering some of its DSL, that is high-speed internet prices, below that of dial-up. If they migrate that across their network into the Bell South territory, for example, consumers could see lower prices. Bell South hasn't cut its DSL prices as aggressively.
Well, what about the concern that, you know, in the long term, if there's less competition, that they can raise prices for things like internet service?
I think that if you're thinking only of telecom companies, then that might be relevant. But the landscape has changed, Robin. This deal was also driven by the voracious competitors that are the cable companies, as well as, you know, these startups like Vonage that are offering internet-based phone calling. So competition is much more intense across the board. And I don't think that the telecom companies have that much room when they're looking at, you know, aggressors like Comcast moving into their territory offering phone and cable and TV and increasingly wireless as well.
It's kind of wacky, as you say, cable companies offering telephone services, telephone companies offering services traditionally offered by cable companies. So you say that it won't have an impact on consumers, but what about just that sense of this is exactly what consumers didn't want, a huge monopoly?
Well, that's if you think, oh gosh, a giant phone company and I've got to deal with them day in and day out. But increasingly, consumers are saying, wait a minute, when I walk the aisles of Staples, for example, I can buy the box from Vonage that gives me internet-based phone service. I don't need to deal necessarily with my phone company. When I deal with Comcast, I can also sign up for that. So there is a lot more choice out there. And yes, big companies that may control, you know, multiple pipes into your house is something that, you know, may make some fearful. But increasingly, consumers understand that they have different choices.
Well, quickly, AT&T still needs to go ahead from the Justice Department, the Federal Communications Commission, and local regulators in Bell South's nine-state territory. Do you see it going through?
I do see it going through.
Brian Groh of Business Week speaking to us about AT&T's plan to buy Bell South. Brian, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin. Thank you.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, a violin made by a conscientious objector during World War II finds its way home. You're listening to Here and Now. Crash crashed the Oscar party last night. The ensemble drama about race relations beat out the heavily favored gay cowboy romance Brokeback Mountain for the Best Picture Oscar. Both were small, low-budget films that didn't gross more than $80 million at the box office, compared with $380 million for the latest Star Wars movie. Crash is about the intersecting lives of a diverse group of Los Angelinos, including a well-to-do African-American couple who turn on each other when the wife wants to report being pulled over and harassed by white police officers.
You actually believe they're going to take anything you have to say seriously?
Do you have any idea how that felt? To have that pig's hands all over me? And you just stood there. And then you apologized to him?
I mean, what did you want me to do? Get us both shot?
That's Dandy Newton and an unrecognizable Terrence Howard, who was also nominated for his role as a pimp wannabe hip-hop star in Hustle and Flow. Well, joining us is Christian Science Monitor film critic Peter Rayner. And Peter, I'm wondering, you were in the auditorium when Crash was announced. How big an upset was this?
It was a pretty big upset. There's an intangible feeling in the air when you feel that there might be an upset coming and it hasn't happened yet. And then you get to the Best Picture, which is the last thing that's given out. And lo and behold, that's the big upset. There was no sweep in the air during the show. Brokeback Mountain was not getting everything that you might expect it to get if it was going to really sweep right. The categories.
So these two little films, here they are at the finish line. What do you think, as some are saying, that it was that Crash was set in Los Angeles about race relations that gave it an edge with the Hollywood voters?
I think the push for the movie was to make it seem like it's more than an L.A. film, that it's nothing less than a candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize, full-page ads with entire reviews quoted and so forth. I'm not a big fan of Crash. I like Brokeback Mountain quite a bit. And so, you know, one theory is that in the end, people kind of didn't go all the way and vote for the most controversial movie, which would be Brokeback, and instead, you know, display their liberal credentials by voting for Crash, which in effect is not really as serious a movie in a lot of ways. It just pretends to be.
That's the criticism of it. But let's move on to some of the other predicted winners. Best Actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman for Capote. Best Actress, Reese Witherspoon for Walk the Line. George Clooney for Best Supporting Actor for Syriana. Rachel Weisz, Best Supporting Actress for The Constant Gardener. But it seemed like, you know, everything was sort of going according to plan before the Crash upset. Until the performance of the Best Song nominee and eventual winner, It's Hard Out There for a Pimp from Hustle and Flow. When they won, I mean, your thoughts on that win?
Well, I actually thought it would win. It's a very catchy tune. Lyrics aside, it's not that big a deal, and a lot of people were very happy because it was certainly of the three, the biggest and most spangly and fun production number. You know, and the Oscar show is supposed to be fun, after all.
Well, when they came to the podium, and with all that enthusiasm, as the host, Jon Stewart, said, that's how you're supposed to accept an Academy Award.
Yeah, well, it was fun. I mean, most of the show, I thought, was pretty damped down and straight-faced, and it wasn't really lively enough, given, you know, the nature of some of the movies. So,
well, I want to ask you about that. With Jon Stewart as host, do you think he was also tamped down?
I think he was on his best behavior. It's not a perfect fit, really, I think, to have him as the host of that show because he's very politically barbed and off the cuff. And I was surprised at the lack of political content for the most part in what he did that night, and also especially the opening monologue of his, except for the joke about
Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney shooting Bjork.
We should say, for those who didn't see it, Bjork wore a famously odd outfit one year where she looked like a bird, and so they flashed
right.
to that.
And there was one joke also that he made about how there are a couple of films in contention about journalists who fight to tell the truth, and they're both period films, of course. But aside from that, I thought that he was on his best behavior, which was a little disappointing. Mm.
Peter Rayner is film reviewer for the Christian Science Monitor. Peter, thanks so much.
Sure.
And for more on interviews we've done in the past with this year's Oscar nominees and winners, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. You know it's hard out here for a pill. When you're trying to get this money for the real. Three cats in Austria have tested positive for the deadly strain of bird flu, Austria's first reported cases of H5N1 spreading to an animal other than a bird. Last month, Germany also reported a cat case. In Austria, the infected cats lived at an animal shelter where the disease was detected in chickens last month. In addition, Poland today confirmed its first outbreak of bird flu in two wild swans. And the World Health Organization said the lethal strain of bird flu poses a greater challenge to the world than any infectious disease, including AIDS. Since last month, the virus has spread to birds in 17 new countries in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. A man named Howard Scott celebrated his 87th birthday over the weekend in the town of Lacey, Washington. Among the gifts he received was a handmade violin from his grandson, Noel Pritchard. But this was no ordinary violin. Most of it was constructed in 1945 on an island in Washington State, where, at the time, Noel's grandfather, Mr. Scott, was a prisoner. Almost 60 years later, Noel began attending the North Bennett Street School here in Boston. It's an institution for old-world trades like cabinet-making, clock-making, and, as luck would have it, violin-making. Noel and fellow student Jess Fox pick up the story.
My grandfather, who I refer to as Bapa, was incarcerated during the Second World War at McNeil Island Prison for being a conscientious objector because of the Japanese internment. And during his time there, he decided to make a fiddle. And since then, his time in prison, he had not returned to it. And when I was done with college, he brought it up again. And I had offered that I would try to do something with the violin.
Actually, it started out with my approaching Noel about making some end tables for our bedroom. My name is Jess Fox, and I'm a student at the North Bennett Street School in their violin making and repair program, and jokingly suggested that he would have some violin work in trade that I could do for him instead of paying him the cash for the tables.
And I went home, and I had remembered about this violin that my grandfather had started, and after that, I just offered it up as a trade, and things dovetail together.
On the one hand, there's some problems with old wood and trying to pick up where somebody else left off. You don't really understand their working methods, and you don't really know the intentions. Luckily, there was a three-ring binder full of letters that Noel's grandmother had sent to his grandfather in prison with the instructions on how to build this thing.
It says, Thursday night, May 3rd. The book says about the back, belly, and side of the violin that it is most important to have the woods cut properly and apportioned.
The rib structure was completed. It was in sort of a handmade mold and had been bent. There's some burn marks on the ribs here, which makes me think it might have been bent around a heated pipe or even a hot water pipe or something like that. Not sure. The plates were carved. Didn't have any F-holes or a base bar in the top, so I've had to do that. The scroll was fully carved, but it was separate from the body of the instrument, so the rest is just assembly. I'm not sure how it's going to sound. The shape of the arching really dictates a lot of the sound, the shape of the arching and the thickness of the plates. But the thicknesses are pretty close to where they should be, and the plates have some flexibility, so it could sound very good. Make sure it's in tune. I absolutely did not make this instrument, and I feel that way because it just feels like I'm a part of this story. I'm just assisting in this story, and Noel's grandfather is very much the person that made this instrument. I would say half to two-thirds or better of the work was already done by the time it came to me, so for that reason alone, and the fact that all the parts that were already finished were those that defined the shape and the character of the instrument, I just helped it to come to completion. Uh, today is the exchange of the projects that we've been working on. The violin is finished and set up and ready to play, and my shaker nightstands for our bedroom are finished as well, so we're handing them off.
The hopes are that I will bring it back to home, which is in Washington State, and present it to my grandfather. And during this time, I've had the chance to take lessons from Jess. I haven't been the best student, but I was going to play a tune for him just to show that it can make some sound. I've learned, you know, basic scales, how to read some of the music. That was just a scale in what note is it, Jess?
It's an A.
That's an A scale. That's about as far as I get right now. I've been kind of behind on some of the lessons, but anyway, it's nice to play a violin that's going to go home. It's a sunny afternoon, March 4th, out on the West Coast, far away from Boston, where my grandfather is going to receive the surprise gift of the completion of his violin. We're just right now going to walk right inside the building where the anxiety will begin. Well, with much anticipation, we came downstairs, and there was a circle of family in this basement reception room. I just simply stated that it was his birthday, and I had a surprise for him.
It's a surprise coming all the way from Boston, and it's something that is over 60 years old in the making. And not that it was any... I mean, it was... My friend here, Jess, was gracious enough to complete the violin that you started at McNeil Island, and here it is.
I'm sorry I can't play it.
As far as I know, it's mild Alzheimer's is what he is experiencing, and also known as sundowners. In that, though, he was tremendously lucid. It was like he slipped back into time, almost. He was recalling things about his experience at McNeil Island.
The belly stuff had to come from the garbage because it's another kind of wood.
It was just natural. And when he picked up the violin, it wasn't like there was a step missed in the whole process. He felt it like it was his own. From the very beginning, which it was, and he had remarked about the violin when he was playing, actually, that it was something of an angel, and he would hope that his wife, Ruane, was there, and we assured him that she was right there with us in the moment.
That's it, Papa.
It's come alive.
Our story about Howard Scott's violin was produced by Here and Now's Matt Largy. To see pictures of the violin and the people who made it, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.